Good evening. It feels like some kind of miracle almost that all of us, or each of us, is here right now together on this last Thursday of January at this hour. In this place that is no place, because how can we call this a place? And yet we're all here. And I say it's miraculous because of the infinite possibilities of what could be right now. This is quite extraordinary. And yet we think of it as just, we don't really think about it. Yet if we do, we look at all the possibilities, infinite, and this is what is, just this, right here, right now. I once read that Einstein said there were two ways to live. One was as if nothing is a miracle. And the other is to live life as if everything is a miracle. And this is quite interesting for someone like him to say. Someone who supposedly one of the great minds that had deep, vast understanding of the science of the universe and some kind of nature of reality explained scientifically. And yet, often Einstein came out with things that sound familiar to us in our practice, something like that, which living life as if everything is a miracle. What does that mean? What are the implications of that then? That means to be continually surprised, to be live in an unending openness to the unfolding of the manifestation of life, of what is, without having a fixed idea about it or saying that I have an understanding of it. You know, I think implied in the live as if nothing is a miracle is implied I can understand everything. And we can't, I can't, let's say, I'll speak for myself. I cannot understand the miracle that we are all here right now at this moment. I don't need to understand it. I'm experiencing it as you are, where this is collective experience, but also individual experience. And there's no, I have no need to understand this moment. In fact, if I understand it, then I will probably not experience it fully in the same way as I do when I don't seek to understand it. So what does that mean then for daily life? There are things we have to understand. You know, earlier I was speaking with Joe and he was telling me about his project for this, the house that he's seeking to renovate in the south of France in Arles. And it's been this long process of getting architect, getting approval from the city, negotiating, figuring it all out. So there are elements of that that have to be understood. There has to be an understanding of the building code, of the laws, of the materials that will be needed, of the plans that the architect has drawn up, of the needs that Joa and Delphine have decided they need for the place. There's a whole series, an abundance of things that need to be understood. And yet, fundamentally, there's no understanding. It's a plunge into the unknown. And I just use that example because it was not so long ago when we were talking about Joa, and it's an example of understanding things and yet not knowing. And the beauty of the project, of any project, is that element of not knowing. Without it, the project is kind of flat and probably disappointing, because we will engage in things and expect things and they won't turn out the way that they are expected to be. Whereas if we don't expect, of course, we have expectations. I'm sure Joa and Delphine have expectations of lot, you know, and they're putting a lot of resources into this project. So obviously they have some expectations. And yet on some level, they don't know. They don't know what it will be. And that's part of, like I said, that's part of the beauty of it. Shogyam Trungpa defined art in many different ways, but one of the ways that he defined it was the unfolding of the uncensored mind. So when the mind becomes starts censoring, then the artfulness of life is limited. Everything is limited when we start censoring, but he's speaking in terms of art, but we can talk about that in terms of our life. As you know, I like to talk about the art of life, the heart and the art of life. Your life is your work of art. And when we can live it free of our limitations, the art can fully express itself. So just take that example of Joa's project. All of the planning and all of the thinking and all of the projecting and all of the expectations are helpful and necessary to a certain extent. And yet the true beauty and art of that project will emerge when all of that is let go of. And it already is, in fact, because they've had to let go of a lot as they go along. And we all have things in our life like this, right? So we have projects and we have to let go of certain elements. There's this guy who is one of, I heard about him in two ways. One from Tiago, who is trained in pottery. He doesn't work. He now works as a restorer of objects, but he knows how to make pots and bowls. And he told me about this, one of the finest potters in England, whose name is Rupert Spira. And I also heard about Rupert Spira because he has stopped making bowls, these beautiful, fabulous bowls and pots and objects that he made. And he is a teacher of Vedanta, pre-Buddhist Indian teaching. And so I've heard of him because my husband follows him and does retreats with him. So and it's fascinating because when he was asked, someone asked him why he stopped making pots. this was in a spiritual context, and someone asked him why he stopped, because at some point he stopped making his pots, which are still, you know, these amazing objects of art that are in museums and are sold for, you know, unbelievable prices. But he doesn't make them anymore. And he said, well, I haven't stopped. The poetry that he writes and the teaching that he gives now, for him, it's the same thing as making pots. It's just another manifestation of it. And I read that he actually stopped making pots at one point because the bowls he was making were getting wider and wider and wider, and, you know, kind of opening like this, and then would collapse because they were getting wider and wider and wider. And he had started writing words on them. First, he had made little lines, beautiful little lines on the pots, on the bowls. And then he started, instead of making these lines, he started putting words, and he would write things that were coming out of his practice and his experience of Vedanta is very much about non-duality. In Zen, it's familiar to us because it's about non-duality. And so he would write these beautiful things. And when the pots were getting wider and wider, the bowls were getting wider and wider, and he would try to write these things on it, they would collapse. And he said, he realized he had to stop. He didn't know what he would do, but this wasn't working. And so he stopped making the pots to see what would happen. And he started just writing his texts. And then he eventually started, he was studying with his teacher, and then he eventually started teaching and realized that it was all the same. It was just a different manifestation of his art, his expression of, what did I say about Trungpa? The uncensored mind, or the, oh, it's too bad Tiago is just joining us now. Something about the endless expression of the uncensored mind, or something, is Trungpa's definition of art. And so this for him, this is just another expression of it, whether it's making pots. Hello, Tiago. I was just talking about Rupert Spira. whether it's making pots or writing poetry or giving his teachings. And he's very similar to Nisargadatta, it's the same lineage, if you will. And Nisargadatta is the one who, the text that is written on the back of one of my rakusus, which is, when I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love or compassion. Between these two, my life turns. And Rupert Spira said something similar. He said, in ignorance, I am something. So this is what we call delusion. Ignorance meaning only seeing the dualities. And so having a fixed, I am something, and you are something. And we're objects and subjects, right? So in ignorance, I am something. In understanding, I am nothing. So he's using understanding in a little bit different way than what I had used earlier, but this is more like to experience the oneness. Then I am nothing. When I'm not experiencing the oneness, I'm something. When I do experience the oneness, I am nothing. Then he adds, and this is where he comes, like Nisargadatta, in love, I am everything. So in ignorance, I'm something. In understanding, or wisdom, we could say, I am nothing. In love, I am everything. This is familiar to us in our Zen practice. It's something like Dogen's first, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. So all things are, we clearly identify it all. It's something. Everything is something. Then, when we've had some awareness and some experience of oneness, mountains aren't mountains and rivers aren't rivers. We can no longer identify them as that. It's like saying us here now, it's just this. So the mountain is just a mountain. We can't even, as soon as we call it a mountain, then we've made it something separate. So from this perspective of oneness, of there's nothing, in Rupert Spira's terminology, there's not, it's nothing. And then Dogen says, the third step for Dogen is, and then mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. But it's not like it was in the beginning. And that's where it joins Rupert Spira, where in love, I'm everything. So then we can truly see ourselves and everything as they are. Not as an object, not as a subject, but we're not stuck on the nothing either. Because if we become stuck on the nothing, well, then we become attached to the nothingness, and then we have trouble because we can't function in our relative world. And we don't truly appreciate the mountain. We don't truly appreciate the river. We don't truly appreciate the person. We're not experiencing love, let's say. Because in the nothing, there's not even love. There's nothing. That's what we call the absolute. Or I think it's Maizumi Roshi who said something like, all also speaks to Joshu, but all dualities come from the one. So everything is one, and from that, the infinite possibilities of the dualities arise. So at the bottom of the two, the dualities, is one. And at the bottom of the one is zero. And zero can't be located, but zero has infinite possibilities. So that zero is like the love of Rupert Spira. I like Rupert Spira's phraseology because it's something, it's very simple and it doesn't have Zen, it's kind of Zen jargon to it. Because we can know, we totally identify with being something and someone, totally. We most of the time function that way. We think of ourselves as someone, something solid, the other is other. That's why we have wars. That's why we have mass shootings in the United States. That's why we have populist governments, democratic governments, autocratic governments. Everything you can imagine comes from this separation, this belief in something and someone fixed. But then when we sit, because when we sit and do our meditation practice like we just did for a half an hour, we're stepping back from that. We're stepping back from being something and someone and attaching to things and just letting things be for 30 minutes. Even if you're not totally aware of that while you're doing it, that's really what it is. You're just sitting, you're doing nothing for 30 minutes, not interfering, not projecting, even though your mind is interfering and projecting. But we try to come back, we try to come back, we try to come back. That's our intention anyway. And then there, if we can have a little glimpse in that time, we see that there's nothing. There's no one and nothing. We might not phrase it like that, But it's kind of like when I talked about Rupert Spira making the bowls wider and wider and wider and wider and wider. That's what that is. But then at some point, they became too wide and they collapsed. And so then he had to come back to, okay, it's not just wider and wider and wider and wider. I have to come back, I have to understand what, or not understand, I'm not going to use his word understand again. I have to come back to, how can I experience this nothing, this wider, 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 but here and now, in the circumstances with the reality, quote, of the forms in the relative world. So the bowls he was trying to make wider and wider and wider, it just wouldn't work. And he dropped it. And then he found, like I said, making pots in a completely different way, making bowls with his poetry, with his teaching, another expression of it. Coming from that place of love, though. Because he could let go of that form that he was attached to and open to some other expression, which fit his circumstance, his expression. It was the appropriate expression from where he was at that moment. So, once again, it's just about becoming less and less attached to a project, to an idea, to a belief in some opinion, because what happens is when we become attached to our limited point of view and our limited opinions, then we only associate with people who share those opinions, or we are in conflict with people who don't. Whereas if we're not fixed, if we're not attached to those ideas, then we can be open to other possibilities. When we can see that the equivalent of Rupert Spira saying, I am nothing, it's that it's not solid. My opinion is not solid. Like Bernie Glassman used to say, it's just my opinion, man. It's just an opinion. It's not solid. And others have opinions too. And can we just open? It doesn't mean that we no longer, we no longer prefer potatoes instead of rice or something. We can still have that preference. But if there aren't any potatoes, we can be free and eat rice. And we won't dislike people who prefer rice instead of potatoes. And this is like a really stupid example, but it's not, because all of the examples we can come up with about conflict are really that simple. They're just a little more, or let's say they're that, in their basic essence, that's the root. They become really complex and elaborate, the attachments we have. And then what arises from those attachments becomes really elaborate and complex. But the basic root is the same. The essence of those conflicts is the same. And at the same time that there are infinite possibilities of the miraculous unfolding of life, there are an infinite number of possibilities of the unfolding of conflict, of delusion, the same. And so, as we sometimes say, there is a choice. You know, we can choose to look into the nature of life and being and not fuel the divisions and the roots that will lead to conflict and violence and suffering and harm. Or we can choose to look into the nature of being and life, nature of mind, our nature. And when we see that, that will give rise to something else. That will give rise to understanding I am nothing, and in love, everything. So that's the really good news, is that there's a choice. There is, because sometimes it seems so hopeless, this world. I know that, you know, some of the things just seems absolutely impossible to end gun violence in America. Really, I just don't see any solution to it. But that's not the whole story, you know, the hopelessness of no solution. There's actually no solution to anything, right? There's just this. And this is a miracle. Miraculous in the sense that it can't be understood, can't be explained. And that's every moment. And that's where, in love, I am everything. That's where love is. I'm everything. So if anyone would like to share anything or ask a question, I know this is maybe not so clear for everyone. I don't know if there's some way I could be saying this differently. I'm sure there is some way I could say it differently. This is what came tonight, because I had recently heard from my husband about Rupert Spira again, and so I was thinking about him. And then having the discussion with Joa, and one thing leads to another. And then the miracle of us, it struck me when I turned on my screen and we were all here, what a miracle it was. Ready.
What is the name of the author again that you were quoting?
Rupert, I'll put it in the chat. You know, I don't know. He probably has written a few books, but there's a lot of stuff on YouTube and then articles and interviews with him. Maybe Thiago knows if he has any books. I don't know.
There's a few podcasts as well.
And the quote?
The quote, yeah, I can also put that in. It's in ignorance, I am something. In understanding, I am nothing. In love, I am everything. And you can see pictures of his work online. Beautiful, beautiful bowls. I mean, amazing. Just the few I've seen, right, Tiago? I mean, really beautiful stuff.
Yeah, what I like about him is that he started as a functional ware potter. So he made cups and saucers and things for use. And then, yeah, he became thinner pots, thinner. And then he started writing on them. And then there was just writing. And then,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
Well, good evening, everyone. Roshi, when you were talking about there being a solution or not being a solution, I remembered something. I don't know if it's a quote from someone, but sometimes you've said this. If we want to fix it, that means we think it's broken.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to cure it, we think it's sick. And I was thinking, when you're talking about the solution, if we want to come up with a solution, then we think there is a problem. Probably, I don't know what do you find solutions for? What problems? Probably. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's not a, well, yes, we can call it a problem or anything, but yes, so the way we look at it means a lot. It can change.
Yeah, absolutely.
If we don't look at something in terms of finding a solution, find some other way of looking at it. It can change.
Yeah, and I can't remember the whole quote, but that is what it's like. And she comes down to, if the answer is serving. So serving, responding to the moment. But it really is. So say I gave this example of, you know, firearms in America, guns in America. You could take away all the guns. I mean, you can't really, that's why it's so hopeless. But even if you did, well, then there would be another weapon. You know, there would be a knife. There would be some other way that the violence would be and the harm would be done. So that's why I say the root. We need to go to the root. What is the root of this separation, of this violence? Well, it's separation. It's attachment, you know. It's the Buddha's basic four points, you know. The cause is their suffering, and then the cause of it, and then putting it, how there's a way to put an end to it. There's the path to do that. And we are on that path. So it always seems so, it's absolutely, understand absolutely politics and governments and that they have to do legislation and things like this, but it's very limited. The reach, that the depth of the problems, quote, are not limited. It's not limited. So, no. You know, it's like when we take, so say you have a cough and you take some medicine to stop the cough. Well, it doesn't actually treat the cause, the origin of the cause. It just stops the symptom. So what we're doing here is not about stopping symptoms. We're aware of the symptoms. We see the symptoms. You know, we see gun violence. We see drug addiction. I mean, America is a really sick culture. And we see that. Those are the symptoms. But what's the cause? And we know this from our practice, what the cause is. Because we experience it in our own lives. We experience our own pain and suffering and where that comes from. And how we act when we're feeling that. Last week or the other Saturday, I don't remember when it was, when I talked about not being nice to the lady on the telephone, right? That was coming from, that was it. That was a symptom of that attachment to myself. It doesn't mean you have to be nice to everybody on the telephone. I'm not going to tell that story again, but I don't mean that you have to be nice. It's not about being nice. You know? There's some kind of pop psychology book. What is it? Stop being nice, be real, or be yourself or something, which is actually true. You know, it's not about being nice. But when you are true to yourself, when you know who you truly are, then you do much less harm. And you end up being what some people might consider nice, but others would not, because you're not necessarily being nice. And it's really, it's every moment. So like I could say right now, tonight, did I want to sit down and give a Dharma talk? Not necessarily. I didn't not want to, but I didn't necessarily want to either. And yet, I'm totally free in this regard to drop whatever I think about it and just do it. Not good, not bad, not nice, not nice, just free. And until the very last moment when Juan says, will you speak? I still don't know. And then whatever arises, I say yes or no. but I try to remain that fluid with it. And this is kind of an easy situation for me because I've been doing it for so long and I've trained so much in this. But when I first started doing this, it was not like that. I didn't want to give Dharma talks. And with every occasion I had to not do it, I didn't do it because I didn't want to do it. And then I realized I was really attached to that. And then, so then when I had my own Sangha, when I was building our Wildflower Sangha, I actually created the situation where I had to give a talk. First, it was once a month. We used to, I don't know if Joa remembers this, in the early days, we used to do it like the first Monday of the month or something, because Delphine was free that night. And there weren't very many people sitting with us. And so we tried to make it so most people would be there. That was once a month I gave a talk. And then when we decided to do a second night of sitting during the week, I said, okay, I'm going to do a talk every week. And it was on Friday night. And I had to work on Fridays. So I would come directly from work, and I made myself do that. I gave myself that discipline to do it. And it was a wonderful training. Maybe the Dharma talks weren't always so good. I mean, I don't even know now if they're so good, but it doesn't matter. It wasn't about being good or not good. It was that it was important for me to give myself that discipline to overcome my attachments, because what I really wanted was to share the Dharma from the very beginning. So, and that was a vehicle to do it, was in that space at that time and that with those people. So I did it. But I had to let go of my attachments to it, to what I should say, to not say, whatever. Just do it. Ready?
Which is what we do when we sit. We try not to get attached to what we think. We try to not be attached to anything. Sitting, what it is. So we are trying to emulate that behavior.
So how does that go for you?
It's every day is different. Sometimes easy, sometimes not, but the more I do it and the more I'm just accustomed to let go and not to judge. Because at the beginning, I just wanted to stand up after 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But now I know that after a while, everything will be settled down in my head. So I'm just waiting. I wait. It's coming anyway. So the calm will come at some point anyway.
What will come? Sorry, what?
The calm, the serenity. Yeah. It will come. It will come at some point. It's like sleeping. If you try to sleep, it's not coming. But if you're just there, it's going to come. So you don't have to struggle. Just have to be there in your bed.
Anyone else? How does that go for you? Whether on your cushion or in every day, you know, every moment. Adrien?
Well, it seems to be going very quietly. That's for sure. Thank you all. I'm going to be going to bed, that's for sure, very soon as well. How does it go? How's it going? Yeah, thing that sort of caught my attention. So this is not an answer to the question. Was the an uncensored expression or something? Art.
Hmm.
So what I'm understanding also from as well what you said about your discipline in a sense to do Dharma talks or your decision and then the sort of discipline or structure that you created in order to make sure for it to happen somehow. Yeah, I'm I suppose I'm struggling with discipline and censorship. So this is how it's going, I suppose. You know, so just now before I arrived, just before I came home to, just on time somehow to sit with you all and be here, so I had a very busy day and I started working outdoor again. So I'm rather exhausted anyway, but it was just a lot of things in a row. And the last moment I closed the little grocery store that we have here in the village that I help, you know, keep open once in a while. And then I went back to the Café Tabar to give back the keys where they are all. And tons of friends in the village were there. It was a really nice atmosphere and people were playing table football. And I was like, you know, so I thought, okay, now everything is in balance. Do I stop? Do I take off my coat? Do I have a drink with them? Do I have a glass of water? Do I play a game of table football? Do I stop all of this and go back home? Anyway. So this is a good illustration somehow of exactly what, well, this is how it's going. I have to choose between these things. And sometimes it's the good choice and sometimes it's the bad choice or something. I don't know. But it's an interesting ride.
What would be a bad choice and a good choice? How do you see that?
I knew that one was coming. So I prepared. No, there are. See, but that's the thing. There are no good or bad choices. If it's the bad choice, or what I would call the bad choice, which is a self-judging, in a way, bad choice, it's... I had this conversation this afternoon with someone about while we were picking carrots in a field. It was 2 degrees outside. and we were talking about the fact that, you know, she was quite a young woman and she was her boyfriend is doing shamanic work and God knows what. And she definitely doesn't want to get into this, although she is interested in all of it, because she's afraid of what would come out of her mind. I seem to have heard this a number of times before, and I probably said this myself at some point. And so, I don't know, at some point, the part of the conversation became that I shared this idea that our unconscious is always on our side somehow. So there's never, you know, even if we feel tricked by it or something, it will always be it's always a good and well-intentioned or something. So I'm saying this because that means that there are no what seems like a bad choice to me at some point, maybe for other reasons, is in fact me and my unconscious, my consciousness and my unconscious or whatever, me just putting myself through something to learn. And there's a very good reason for it. It's just sometimes those reasons are complicated to to work out or something. So you're going round and round and round on the same roller coaster sometimes. Yeah, that's kind of how it feels to me these days, sometimes at least. And other times it's, you know, I can be picking some more carrots in the same field as the. And in fact, there is nothing similar, and it's a miracle. And I mean, and everything is a miracle. Of course, there are miraculous things. You know, every lump of earth I turn over to pick those carrots, there are hundreds of worms all over. So and you realize how full of life all of this is, and all of this is to feed us, ourselves, etc., etc. And you know, when the wind and the sky and the bird flying over and the people and everything is miraculous, also in that sense that you are saying, in the sense also that you were quoting Einstein as well, miraculous in the sense of also how, you know, impossible it all seems, or how little sense it makes that we should all be here, that we should be in this field, and that this carrot, a carrot for Christ's sake, you know, what the hell is that, would be growing. How the hell does that make any sense? And yet, yeah. Something like that.
Thank you. And maybe more than saying it's a good choice or a bad choice, it's just to see what the consequences of any choice is, you know, and to be aware of what will ensue if I make this choice or if I make that choice. And like you say, there can be learning in either, I mean, in multitude of choices. Sure. And as Trungpa always said, you know, trust in the uncensored mind, which is something like, I guess, trust in the unconscious, maybe if we're talking that terminology, I don't know. But trust in the uncensored. And that's what we always say, trust. With koans, you know, we say trust because it's going to be something. The koan is pointing to the essential and our the essential and oneness, and our experience of that is, we have an experience of it, but we don't trust it. That's why we say trust. We're almost out of time. So if anyone has one more thing to bring up or point, a comment.
Only one question. Mm-hmm. Last Dharma talk, you talk about abiding.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know the word. And I look at the translation, and it was permanent. Who comes to me, it's permanent. It's that.
The translation in Portuguese was permanence?
Permanence, yeah. Permanence.
The equivalent of permanence? Huh.
Yes.
João,
you know?
I think someone said some word for it, but I don't remember.
Abiding?
It's not permanence, although it is the sense of, you know, in French we would say demeurer, maybe.
Demeurer.
It's to rest.
Yeah.
It's to be present.
Mm-hmm.
Continuously, something like that.
Okay.
Not permanent, though.
Okay.
It's actually not at all permanent because it's impermanent. It's a continuous movement, almost, something like that. Because as soon as we stop and fix ourselves, then we're no longer abiding. Something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Nobody has an idea in Portuguese.
Thinking about all this, your Dharma talk from today and the speech from Adriano, and I related that with this abiding. this miracle, this miracle from carrots and worms. It's because they are there, they stay there, they wait the time, and I need to ask the word only because I was relating the things, but I can't explain yet the thing.
Well, maybe we could say that our appreciation of that, of what you said and what Adrien said, of the miracle of the carrot and the worms and the dirt and the, all of it, our capacity to appreciate that arises because we are abiding in this moment. We're not in the unmiraculous. We're not in just the, we don't care. Pick these carrots. I don't care about these worms. We wouldn't even see the worms probably if we weren't abiding presently here. Something like that.
Thank you.
If I may, just I think abide is one of those difficult words to translate in this context. It's like the word. There are a few words like that. Atone is another one. It's difficult because the most literal. There is a more literal sense to all of these words, and abide most literally is about submitting. Like, I think we even in English, we can talk about abiding the law, abiding by the law. I'm not exactly sure what the expression is.
Maybe. I don't know. Possibly. That's maybe one definition, yeah.
So it's, yeah.
But that would mean to acknowledge the law.
Yes, yes, yes. There is something about acknowledging, yes, mm-hmm. I think.
To act within the constraints of the law, that's what it would mean.
Yeah. So we could get into the etymology of these words too. I like atonement. See that? So both of these words start with that prefix a, and that must be some, that probably is not Latin. And because the Latin roots of French, Portuguese, they don't have those words. I don't know. It'd be interesting. Freddie has a comment on that.
But maybe like in French, because demeurer means to live in a demeure and to abide in an abode. So mm-hmm. It's a place and it's a verb. To abide in an abode et demeurer dans une demeure. So at the same time, it's a verb and it's a place to be. Where you live? You live in an abode. Mm-hmm. And you demeure in a demeure. So to abide in the present, it's like the present is your home.
Right, exactly. Yep, exactly. Thank you, Freddie. That's a really pertinent comment. That's it. Yep. Everywhere is your home. And now we will all leave this everywhere and go to some other everywhere. Whether it's Adrien going to bed or me going to have a bowl of soup or whatever. So thank you for abiding here now.